Pleasure. Thanks for coming
out. How are you?
I'm good. I'm rolling some tape for our B-roll.
Of course.
Amazement.
Yeah. Good place to do it.
Yeah, thanks for being late, because I was just sitting here.
It's lovely, isn't it?
And it's just so incredible.
I come to the spa here.
But I'm here because of you. You know, I had no idea where I was going to stay in town, and since you were here.
Oh, so you're staying on this side?
Yeah.
You're staying here?
Yeah, I'm staying right here.
Are the rooms nice?
Yeah. Well, you're about to find out.
Nice.
Tell me. They're good. I mean, so I got an order for dawa.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what we're gonna drink?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So let's go ahead and see if we can get a couple of those going.
All right.
Hi. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
It's good to see you.
Good to see you again.
And you. Okay, Asante. Have a good day.
So these ones for the meal, and these ones for the drink.
Okay. I think we just want two dawas.
Two dawas.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure, it's there.
So?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
With rum.
With rum.
Not vodka.
Yeah.
We do rum.
Yeah.
Also, where should I serve you?
We'll be in room 3.
Room 3.
Yeah, on the patio.
It's okay, no problem.
Okay.
Nice.
All right.
Perfect.
Here, we can get to the spot from out here.
All right. I think they're going to make a hot dawa.
What is a hot dawa?
You can make dawa. The one that you have, that was the one that was kind of invented like as a cocktail.
Yeah.
And then there's the other one that's like, it's like a tea, but you can put alcohol in it.
Oh, so it's like a hot toddy.
Yeah, it's like a hot toddy.
Is that all right?
That's perfect.
Okay. I mean, it's not so cold here, but I'm just through to the end.
What do you mean it's not so cold? We're in our winter.
I mean, it's just, I'm trying to think of a more pleasant
winter
temperature or, yeah. Yes, this is a re-release of my 2019 Nairobi kickoff episode, which was the first of 5 episodes from that great city, most of which have not been yet freely available. Never fear, though, there's a certain timelessness to chatting about the weather, but that pleasant chill in the air in Nairobi in early summer, that is at the heart of everything we're going to be talking about over these 5 episodes in Kenya. That cool climate, it seems, was Nairobi's original sin, the thing that first drew British civil engineers to build a rail depot here in 1899. Pity the poor colonizer, who had been trying to subjugate so many peoples in the unbearable heat. Here at more than 5,800 feet above sea level, way higher even than Denver, the air is dewy and lovely, and it makes perfect sense that it would make for an appealing home base for your average gin-soaked sadist from Old Blighty looking to queen over all of East Africa. So, Nairobi was born, a European city, and this whole region of East Africa became known as the White Highlands, where the land was stolen from the Maasai and Kikuyu with such vigor and arrogance that, of course, you had a string of revolts and massacres and rebellions, and then the Mau Mau uprising, and finally a free Nairobi, capital city of the independent Republic of Kenya. Its airport was built in part by Mau Mau prisoners held by the British in ghastly conditions, and today the airport is named after freedom fighter and first president Jomo Kenyatta. That is just the first taste for any arriving visitor of the conflicting strands of DNA that weave around each other throughout this city. My first attempt to untangle it all starts with Wanuri Kahiu. When we put Nairobi on the calendar, she was the first person we thought of having on the show. When she said she lives in Karen, a particularly green district of Nairobi with a view of the Gong Hills, that's where I decided to stay. She's a leader that way. She communicates this sense of humor and lightness mixed with an intimate moral urgency. If you are a fan of film and disturbed by censorship, you'll know her film Rafiki, the first Kenyan movie to ever screen at the Cannes Film Festival, even as it was banned by the Kenyan authorities back home for reasons relating to, as they called it, gayism. But as you'll hear in this episode, the fights that she fought with Rafiki are still ongoing in the country, and so are her triumphs, which will be coming with more of that quiet and effective force to your favorite streaming platform soon. This is Nathan Thornbergen from Roads and Kingdoms. You're listening to The Trip, drinking with exceptional people around the world.
Why is that such a common question? What is that breakfast question? What did I have for breakfast? I had porridge.
Porridge?
I had sour millet porridge with spice.
What kind of spice?
Cardamom, cinnamon, brown sugar, and but the porridge flour is made from millet.
Made from millet.
Yeah.
Which gives it.
And then they sour it somehow. Oh. So it's like sour millet porridge. Damn. And then I like to put coconut milk and spice in.
That sounds like, you know, porridge is usually this just bland. That's what it's supposed to be. Sounds like you're going in an opposite direction.
Oh my gosh, no. I discovered porridge. I've been discovering porridge all my life, I think.
It's a process of continual rediscovery. It's,
honestly, like my grandmother's porridge was the best porridge in the whole world. It was the best porridge. And then I lived in Mombasa for a while, and then I tasted the porridge in Mombasa, and then that was the best, and I started feeling guilty about liking another porridge more than my grandmother's.
Really? Yes. Did you have a chance? Is your grandmother still with us?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So she couldn't even taste it.
Yeah, you couldn't even like get her on board.
No.
Huh? You couldn't say do it like that, but yeah. Also a little bit like Mombasa.
Yeah.
You're still living out in Mombasa or no?
No,
you're here full time.
Uh-huh. I'm Nairobi based.
Why was what was that dalliance with the coast?
I've always wanted to live at the coast. I feel like the coast is just a super magical, wonderful. I can't even explain. Mombasa is just like it's beautiful. It's one of my. It's like going to the coast is the Kenyan coast is my happy place. Always has been.
Yeah.
And the Indian Ocean and the beaches and the coast on the south coast and the north coast are the most beautiful beaches anywhere I've ever seen.
Damn. All right, let's go.
Yeah.
What are we doing up here in the hills?
I know. So yeah, Mombasa is where it's at. Diani is where it's at. So I try and spend as much time as possible. So for a while I thought I could live there.
Yeah.
I was just like, you know, I can live anywhere.
Yeah.
So I moved to Mombasa.
Well, you can live anywhere.
I mean, you can in theory.
But you can't.
But you can't.
Yeah.
Mombasa is super small.
Yeah.
It's like, it was small for what I needed to do. So I was constantly like jumping on like an extra flight just to get out of Mombasa.
Into opportunity.
Into life.
Yeah.
And work.
Yeah. I'm going to pull a Thomas Friedman on you. I was talking to my cab driver,
right?
And he was from Mombasa.
Yeah.
He was saying the same thing. He's like, everybody he grew up with is living in Nairobi now
because
it's nice and there's no jobs. But that's, I mean, you know, I guess LA maybe is an exception. I don't know. Like, although the people there are trying to make it not nice. but they, you know, beautiful places, great beach, never have good jobs. There's never enough.
No, there's never enough.
You always got to go back to some... you know, godforsaken place like New York to get your work done. Okay, so...
I keep on saying, actually, whenever people say, where are you from? Like, if I'm visiting LA and people say, where are you from? I'm always like, the other East Coast.
Is that true? You're an East Coaster?
No, because yeah, Kenya's the other East Coast.
And you're from the Great Lakes? Does that work too?
No.
Kind of.
If I was.
Yeah. I don't know. Isn't this... all right, so you're an East Coaster.
I mean, Kenya being on the East Coast.
Yeah.
But not like a proper East Coaster would still be Mombasa again.
Yeah.
The default.
How far back? So you were born and raised in Nairobi.
Yeah.
But then speaking of hopping on a flight to get into life, you hopped out pretty young into university.
Even before that, like the last 2 years of high school, I did them in the UK.
Uh-huh. What was that like for you?
That's when I realized I was black. I didn't know
before. It's a hard thing to figure out here.
I didn't know.
Wow.
I didn't know it. I unlike now, I hadn't heard of it. I wasn't having race conversations with my parents. I'm having race conversations with my children now. It wasn't a thing. Tribe was a thing.
Yeah.
And we were trying to get over that and, you know.
Right.
But race wasn't a thing. I remember I had a white auntie and she was like, you know, like different. She was just like the odd person out.
You're like,
I have a white auntie, Suzanne.
Yeah. Oh
and I
God.
Was like, wow, you know, it's like, it's just because she was different.
It's a long way to go to learn that lesson. But that is, I suppose if there's something that we, this is no silver lining, but it doesn't take long to learn about blackness in the States. I don't want to date this, but I was just before you got here, I was watching Ta-Nehisi Coates gave testimony in front of Congress about reparations today or yesterday.
Oh, I didn't see that.
It was amazing. And, you know, he has like these very like holistic ways of looking at the whole stretch of history that we have in the States. And it is like, I don't know, it's just put me in a mood, because he also was raising a kid who, talking about having those conversations, just like, it's like a very large part of parenting in his life, at least, is like having those conversations about how, and here you never had to.
No, and we still don't. And the only reason I'm having those conversations is because of what's happening to people at large, not necessarily to what's happening to people in Kenya.
So they can understand the bullshit that's
happening
in the UK, in the States.
And this is what your global perspective, this is how we live here, but this is the global perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is what's happening to black. I mean, and my children, I'm trying to find it's not even the tone, just the right way to start having conversations. But if I do get upset, I don't hide it from them. Like if I feel like there's a sense of injustice, I don't hide it from them. But I just try and say it in a way that they would understand.
How do you, because I think in a lot of the films that you make, you're creating, and some of them, I'm thinking of Pumsy in particular, you're creating a world that doesn't exist, right? It's sort of a futuristic, model that you get to decide, the different parts that go into it. How do the characters think and talk about blackness there?
It's interesting. The conversation about race in Pumsy was very accidental.
How's that?
Because when I wrote the film, it was cast all black. And then on the day of the shoot, the person who was meant to be the cleaner dropped out, so we had to recast it on that morning, and there was a white actress who was available, and then she became the cleaner. And then people started like adding to it. They'd be like, "Yeah, she's the white person's the cleaner, and all the black people are not."
Right.
And I was just like, "Okay, if that's how you want to read into it, that's cool." But it wasn't a conversation about race. It was still a conversation. For me, the biggest conversation has always been class.
Yeah.
It's never been race, because I think race is aggravated by class. You know what I mean? And I'm talking about class in Kenya and in an African perspective. My conversations have mostly been about class, because that's what I've seen.
Right.
And that's what I've experienced. But in other places, race is the one that is most, it's like, it's so much more.
Yeah, it is. But actually, that's part of this debate that we're having, that I hope we continue to have, and I hope it doesn't die in subcommittee, as it well might in the States. I think at its best, it's not a moral conversation about, loving your fellow man or something, but it's a very technical conversation about what's been taken.
Yes.
And that's, and the money that's been taken, and the reason why, I think the average household worth in the States of an African-American family is like 10% of the average white family. Like that's so when you talk about class, like that's everything that we think we know about race comes from theft, and like the kind of outcropping of that. So it's interesting that for you, I guess that is sort of, that plays out here in the same way. Those are the conversations that are still dominating, even in a completely African kind of context in your films.
Yeah, it becomes a conversation about access, right? Access to health, access to schools, access to safety, access to lighting, access to like water. It's super basic. Access to democracy. And I think that's why I think that there's just so many layered conversations about democracy now as a result, because if you don't have access to your basic needs, as people don't, not only here but also in America, then what are you voting for? You're voting for your basic needs. You're not exercising your right to democracy. You're exercising your right to survival. You're voting for security, the person who's going to just guarantee you your basic human rights. So I've always had like a really complicated relationship with, like, when we're choosing how to vote, what are we really thinking about? Especially if you're in a space that your necessities have been grabbed.
Right.
And
yet people seem to continue to vote in ways that will, that's sort of the...
But they were voting for what they... I think the people were voting for what they needed a sense of security,
yeah,
a sense of basic things, to feel, it really comes to feeling whole. There's a lot of like, and I feel like one of the things that we keep missing out, which is so important, especially when it comes to politics, is emotional intelligence. Because the way people are voting, they're not voting necessarily with how you think and you're voting for how you feel, or how this person is going to make you feel, or how they're going to enrich your life in some sort of a way, which seems more about emotional intelligence than it does about what, you know?
I wonder if we could educate. I mean, obviously, you know, these two countries that you've been connected to overseas have lost their damn mind recently, you know? I think, although what you're saying, maybe they lost their heart. I don't know. Like, it's true. It's not an intellectual thing.
It's not an intellectual thing.
How do you do like voter education that, you know, lets people get it in touch with how they're feeling? Like, you're voting mad, but let's talk about that feeling. Why are you so angry?
Yeah, why are you so angry? How can I make you feel better?
Seriously.
What makes you feel better?
Oh, but I think they're saying, I think they're telling us, and I think it's not what we want to hear.
It's probably that as well.
What would make me really feel better is kicking 100,000 Polish dentists out of the UK, you know? That's the thing.
Oh my.
Well, since we're on such great topics, I'll deflect from all of our problems in the West and get right into the decision here 4 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Which was crazy. I was just reading, so the context, obviously, which our listeners should totally know, of course, is Rafiki was, I think, maybe your highest profile film. It was the first Kenyan film to be an official selection at Cannes.
Yeah.
It made news all around the world, not just for being a great film, but then for having been banned by the, what is it, the Kenyan Film
Classification
Board, which, talk about dystopian futures. It's got a great title in the lead for that. But I was reading about their decision back then to not allow the film to be screened here in Kenya. And some of the language sounded a lot like the recent Supreme Court ruling in Kenya, which upheld the criminality, I guess, of same-sex relationships. It was like a very, you know, it's like the same people, same. They're basically like, hey, we're Kenyan. This is what it means to be Kenyan.
No, because I reject that. I reject that that's what it means to be Kenyan. Because if we really just think about what it means to be Kenyan, just like if we were to look into the American Constitution as a way of trying to figure out what it means to be American, then that language is not reflected in the Constitution. And that language is not reflected in the mottos of Kenya. The mottos of Kenya is peace, love, and unity. Seems pretty simple.
I mean, that's right out of a gay pride slogan.
Thank you. They should just have a flag.
Big old rainbow flag.
On the monument.
Yeah, right. No kidding.
Yeah, and the Constitution is super clear about some of the things that are happening. I mean, the Constitution says, the ruling that stayed the criminalization of same-sex relations was incredibly devastating. I remember listening to it, and I think everybody who was listening for it remembers where they were, and remembers, some people remember when they switched off, turned away. Some people remember, but it was just the most devastating ruling. It was the complete denial of people's existence. It was the complete denial of people's existence. It was horrific, it was tragic, it was appalling. Like, I don't have the language to describe that court ruling. It was incredibly unfortunate. And that is not what it means to be Kenyan. Those words are not what it means to be Kenyan. I can't describe my country using the same language because it's not that. It's not that. That court ruling was just, it was an image of us showing a lack of empathy. It was us being unkind. It was that version of us, but that's not all the version of us that there is. And I wouldn't put that version on such a beautiful, blessed country.
In your heart, did you think it would go down this way?
I don't know why I was optimistic. But also I made a film that I was optimistic that it might not be banned either. So I think I suffer from optimism.
Well, this was, I mean, I have to say that was one of the incredible, where people are damning themselves by their own, you know, kind of by their own words and judgments. One of the things that was tied up into the reason why the Film Classification Board banned Rafiki was it was too hopeful.
It was too hopeful. Which, it wasn't remorseful enough.
Which, you know, it's just a stunning thing. And I remember reading some interviews that you'd done at the time. And you're like, I'm an optimistic person. This is the ending that film is going to have.
Yeah,
you know,
you can't take out the joy. And it was strange because I was in a meeting with the classification board, like, and there was many of them. And the only thing they honed in after an hour's conversation was not the hand holding, was not the kissing, was not the affectionate touching, was not the long lingering looks, was just the ending is not remorseful enough. And the song at the end is too love song. It's too much of a love song. It's too sweet. Please remove it. God. That's why I remember the word remorseful so clearly, because it was just, it started to redefine my relationship with that word, because I never thought it would be applied in that way. You can have the movie, just make it remorseful.
Just make everyone regret who they are,
yeah,
and what they've done,
yeah,
and how they got to the end of that film.
And we'll give you a rating.
It's stunning. I mean, it's like the town that, you know, banned dancing, you know, or something. It's like, it just happens. It does happen. And you just, you know, you just are always trying to, well, at least I'm trying to figure out how can these people let these words cross their lips without, and not realize that, you know, whatever path they took in life, they are now the people that said, there's too much joy in this. Now we quash, you know? Can you imagine a young child? When I grow up, I'm going to find a piece of joy and I'm going to throttle it.
I'll suffocate it with remorse.
I will be the pro-remorse voice in the room. It's a really, I mean, talk about emotional intelligence. You want to get those people, and they exist in every country. You just want to get them on the couch and say, hey,
what happened?
Hey, buddy.
Calm down.
How did we get here? You want to talk about it?
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Oh man! Well, see, there it is. I think you know, it's very clear from the way you talk about it, and obviously the just the straight facts of the ruling. It is devastating. It comes after a 3-year court battle and a, you know, millennia of like trying to coexist here. But still, you're finding some joy in this and.
You have to, but joy exists whether you want to find it or not, because of the absurdity of life. Like, life is so absurd. I have an amazing filmmaker friend called Hajuj Kuka, and his first film was called Beats of the Antonov. And Beats of the Antonov is set like in the Nubia Mountains in Sudan. And there's this scene in the documentary where all these bomber planes come across, just dropping bombs, right?
Yeah.
And people would jump down these holes and hide there, right? And usually they know, because it happens often enough to know the rhythm of how the bombs land, right? And they usually do, they just drop 3 at a time. So they'd listen out for the 3. And then they'd, when the 3rd one dropped, they'd just burst out in laughter. Because they were just like, and then they'd start teasing each other. Oh, I saw the way you were running. You ran like a goat and you fell down. Ha, 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 ha. Like, it was like, it just became this joyous moment of being alive. So even in the midst of war, the absurdity of life is just like, it takes you out of it. And you're just like, what the hell just happened? Because I think that there's this illusion that people who live in specific spaces are accustomed to a type of treatment or are accustomed to a type of way of life. Like, often I'm asked, wasn't I surprised? Yes, I was surprised when my film was banned because I'm not used to it. I'm not accustomed to being mistreated.
Right.
that's not the reality. And I'm not accustomed to seeing something very plainly written in the Kenya Constitution about freedom of expression and having that quashed. I'm not accustomed to that. And people in places of war are not accustomed to death.
Yeah,
it happens because of where they are, but they're not. It's not something they're just like, well, yeah, you know. I think that everything is as real as an emotion as anywhere else, and sometimes we kind of like, oh, that place, oh, Syria. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
As if they're used to it. Nobody's used to that. Nobody's used to running from their homes. Nobody's used to ending up under overpasses. Nobody's used to having their children put in cages.
Yeah.
Nobody's used to children being taken from them like is happening in America. Nobody is used to that. Nobody becomes used to it. Injustice is not something that becomes familiar or comfortable. Injustice remains uncomfortable, and it should.
It's also about, these are actions that are done to people. Well, speaking of injustice, now we have to drink.
Yes.
All right. Let me, this seems like something that you are going to have to lead me through.
Yeah, they made proper dawa.
So they've made a proper dawa. What does that mean?
So a dawa is hot honey, lemon, ginger, and sometimes turmeric.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Get those West Side ladies in LA on this. This could be the next kick, man. Especially
dawa
if it's got that turmeric.
Yeah.
Dawa is the truth.
Dawa
there
is
it
the
is.
Truth. And right. Then you can have, and then you can make it alcoholic. It's like, you can make it like a Kenyan hot toddy if you want to add anything to it.
Well, listen, it is... well past 5 o'clock in this continent. Now, you can do this with rum or vodka.
Yeah. I'm not sure what kind of rum they gave us.
It is like a very sweet rum. Interesting.
And is it spiced?
Yeah, yeah, spiced. It's like they have this rum in Mumbai, the Old Monk. It's like
really?
I really like it. It's just like... it's just super spiced, pretty sweet. Nothing rough about it. So, all right. So we have this sort of the tea, the dawa, the rum you pour in, and then honey.
Yes.
Oh my God, this is going to do amazing stuff for our voices too.
And jet lag.
And jet lag. Well, that, yeah, I did. What did I got in? I have to say, I love Kenya Airways.
Oh, you did the direct flight from New York?
Yeah, yeah.
Nice.
It's just, it's awesome. It's, you know, I've never been to Kenya before, but getting places in Africa, it sucks. It's hard.
Have you never been to Kenya before?
I've never been, no. This is my first day. So.
Oh my gosh, karibu. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you. I mean, this is like...
It's a soft landing.
Yeah, I feel like it's okay that I waited because I must be living right or something, or because this is great, and now I got my dawa and watch, my voice is just gonna
melt that voice.
Holy shit, that's got a lot. That's like your porridge. That's like got spices and base and damn. Yeah, hot toddy usually is just like, you just taste the hot.
Yeah, and then like the hot lemon.
Yeah, yeah, and the lemon, right.
Yeah.
This is like, I'm going to say 25 other things happening.
Yeah. It's sparkly in your mouth.
And now they make a cold cocktail out of this too.
Mm-hmm. They make the cold cocktail is just lemon, honey, ice, and vodka.
Okay. No, this is good. It's crazy. Yeah. I'm like now distracted by all the stuff that's happening in the back of my throat, you know? It's tea. Yeah. It's like, I gotta clear my mind here.
Mm. Honey, lemon, ginger, turmeric. Yeah.
Oh, brother. Nice job. Thank you for making that the recommended drink here. All right. Well, we were talking about the uncomfortableness of injustice. I guess, you know, that people don't really get, they don't get used to it. And it is amazing how it's the easiest thing to see, see it as a good fit for other people, like see tragedy or war, you know, just like, oh yeah, that makes sense. You know, we took this show, I was in Iraq, a few weeks ago, and you know, it's such a simple thing, but just talking to people about what they were up to before the war, they all have crazy war stories. But if you don't hear that in the full context of their lives, you know, like the tragedy of Ahmed's brother, like just totally gutting, it was so much, you know, just knowing how he was, how they were before war came was so much more. It just reminds you, it puts you in that place of like, oh shit, of course, like this is a person every bit as much as I am a person.
With a full life and full hopes and dreams and ideas and yeah, all that.
So, you know, to return to the, you know, this injustice of what we're talking about in the Supreme Court ruling here in Kenya, that's a, for you, it's kind of this act of not being seen or being seen to exist. I mean, I forget some of the, I mean, there's just so many nuggets to pull out of that ruling.
Oh, they were.
But one of them was just like, well, you know, the science shows it, or doesn't prove that, you know, people are born this way.
Yeah, that was a good one. there's no science to prove that people are born this way. That was a good one. There was no way to prove that people in the LGBT community are being treated worse off than any other person. They even kind of tried to dispel the idea of an LGBT community because they're like, the law says any man that has sex with another man, he doesn't have to be queer.
That's very inclusive of them.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You could just be cruising.
You could just be heteronorm.
Yeah.
Having sex with a man for the rest of your life, but you could you're just straight. But you're straight having.
So you don't, ergo, you don't exist as a class that needs protection.
No.
I mean, obviously, listen, we are fighting this fight still in the U.S. and 50 years after Stonewall, people are trying to bring it back down. But it is that, it's that amazing circular logic of, you know, we never recognized you, so you're not a thing, you know, so that you don't exist in this way of being a class. So some of that is universal, just hater law, you know, kind of around the globe. But there is a thing here in Kenya where, you know, as you were saying, which is this premise that you reject, that this is a Kenyan, you know, they were saying, well, we don't want to get out ahead of public opinion. But it's, you know, inherently Kenyan to discriminate. I mean, against gays, that
doesn't make sense.
Yeah. But also the laws that they're upholding are British laws.
Exactly. They were all colonial laws. There was no laws before then about same-sex relations. I mean, we're talking about, we live in a country where the Swahili, which is the national language, Kenyan, English and Swahili are the national languages. So the national language Swahili, as well as many other Bantu-speaking languages, do not differentiate between he or she in language. You say, wow. They are coming. They are going. There they are. There they are. There's no gender in language. There's, when you're saying, yes, that is a girl child, but you say mtoto wa kike. Otherwise, they're just mtoto, which is just child.
Huh.
And then if you're trying to huyo wa kike, so you just, if you're trying to distinguish them, then you use their gender to be like, no, that one, I'm calling that one. But the language itself, you don't say he came into a room, you say the person has come into the room. So in a country where there is no gender in the actual language, and where the idea of being in relationships, in different types of relationships, of women marrying women, which has happened, with men being married to men because they were the husbands of priests, right? Or the wives of priests, rather. They, you know, there's been such fluidity in gender identity. There's been fluidity in how people live and love. There've been cultures. Even in Kenya, there's cultures where before your rite of passage into becoming an adult, you'll be put with the same sex so that you can learn pleasure without the repercussions of either getting pregnant or whatever. So you could, you know, so there were cultures and customs that encourage same-sex love and exploration in many different ways. Yeah. That is not spoken about anymore.
Right.
That's all changed. So even for us, the idea of LGBT is new because that was never the language that we used, because there was different language, there was different cultures, there was different traditions, you know?
That's fascinating too, because obviously as with so many of these things, it does stem from kind of a false, or what we would see as a false interpretation of history, or kind of, you know, emphasizing or cherry picking through your past, but also LGBT, like we've been having this very, you know, this is a year of remembrance and celebration in the States at the 50th anniversary. It is an American phenomenon and a kind of a Western phenomenon, this style of the gay rights movement. And I wonder, is that a difficulty kind of talking about these things? Because the goals have to be the same, right? You have to be able to live your life in peace and with protection of the law. But while having to do a dance of saying like, no, actually this is a very Kenyan thing, even though, you know, even though some of the language or some of the legal precedent or some of the strategy is adopted from other countries outside. I mean, have you guys been, you know, as saying this large as artists and activists and people who are trying to see change affected, is there work being done to kind of indigenize these things so that people can understand that?
I think that there's been many conversations about it in many different ways. But also we're talking about a very modern society now. We're talking about the Kenyans now. So even if we draw from our past, we're still really dealing with the people that we are now. And who we are now is people who have internet, who have, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Who have access to the greater global world, right? And we're identifying in that nowness, you know, and reflecting who we are now and wanting to talk about who we are now. And yes, the past is important. But also, it becomes this idea of re-education of people. And not only re-education of your own generation, but of an older generation, which is in itself a very tricky process, because they know what they know, and their ideas are their ideas sometimes, you know? I have to say, sometimes I still don't feel like I'm an adult. You know what I mean? And it's always the adults. But they always seem to be there.
Yeah,
there's always adults.
Yeah, that goal is always, the ball is always ahead of you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I think that there's conversations that are beginning to happen as a result of the case that haven't been had. And people are beginning to look at... just, I think, what has become important and how the case is being framed in a really interesting way is the right to privacy. So regardless of what you think and what you hold to be dear and what your tradition is and how we've identified and how colonial laws came and changed our identities, despite that,
yeah,
what is the right of the government to be in your bedroom? Period. What is your right to privacy? What is your right to privacy? And that's like, that became a really important conversation in people who, whether or not they believe or support same-sex relations, could get behind. And I thought that was a really savvy way of arguing the case. But I am also an onlooker on this case, and I just think it's brilliant. I thought it was really savvy, and I'm just glad that we have a chance to appeal, and the ruling will be appealed.
I mean, that was one of the piercing lines, I guess, in Rafiki is one of the characters, I forget which one, is just like, whatever happened to minding your own business, you know, like, which is, it's funny because it's such a universal that, you know, that's a universal quality that people like to think about themselves and like to think about, you know, the way society should work. Mind your own business. you know, like let us, you know, live our lives and you stay out of our affairs.
But even so, I think we're social beings. We'll never mind our own business, but just because we're social beings, right? We won't. But we can keep ourselves out of people's rooms or bedrooms or houses. If you're not meant to be there and you're not welcome, don't be there. Period. We will never mind our own business.
Okay, so there's human nature that you'd have to work against.
Exactly.
Right, but especially if you are going in and you're not going to appreciate what you find, just staying out of it. All right, so there's some hope there. There's a classic, one of your hopeful endings out here somewhere, starting with an appeal possibility. How's that process? When is that going to...
Oh, I have no idea. Yeah. I'm currently in my own legal battle for freedom of expression because we took the Kenya Film Classification Board to court.
So this is still playing out.
Yeah.
Oh.
So the ban was lifted for 7 days, which is great because it was a precedent set about just about freedom of expression. But we're back in court and we're fighting for the larger freedom of expression case because the Constitution allows the freedom of expression, but... the law that was used, again, in the same way with the same-sex relationships, the law that was used to ban my film was created in 1963. So it's like the remnants of a colonial law. And the constitution that was created in 2010 says very clearly everybody has a right to freedom of expression, very clearly.
Yeah.
And it says, and no one has a right to be intimidated for freedom of expression. It's just, there's never been... we've never tested it, and now we're testing it. And we're trying to overturn that law or have it rewritten so that it's more reflective of the current constitution.
How do you, I mean, we're having a conversation that is about kind of law and activism and justice, but I mean, what you really are, among all these other things, is this incredible filmmaker who has to have some giant part of your mental capacity focused on, you know, what am I going to shoot next? How are we going to get it funded? How are we going to put it together? How do you decide then to also take on a legal battle for the good of the culture?
I think it wasn't... first, I had this phenomenal lawyer who was very clear. She's like, this is absolutely... She says, today, it's going to be... they're going to say it's because you're promoting gayism, which is a thing.
Gayism.
Gayism.
That
is a Kenyan word.
Of all the isms.
Yes.
You had to walk into that one. All right.
So I've been accused of promoting gayism. So apart from that's what they're saying today, but my lawyer was like, what are they going to say tomorrow? How are they going to change the rules? Because the rules keep on saying... norms and values, Kenyan norms and values, but there's nowhere norms and values are defined. So who's setting these norms and values parameters? So that's when we decided we were just going to, and also the head of the Film Classification Board, he's an interesting character. So before my film was banned, another film was banned, Stories of Our Lives. And between Stories of Our Lives and mine, 6 cartoons were banned for promoting homosexuality or gayism again.
And a podcast was banned, right? Spread?
No, it wasn't.
Oh, no. Okay.
It wasn't banned. The spread is still on.
Oh, it is. Yeah. Okay. Wow. I thought we'd get these podcasts into the game, but no. Films,
not yet.
Films are the ones that come for.
Films and TV. Yeah. But also, apart from films and TV, so he banned 6 cartoons, including Hey Arnold. I guess it's the phallic-shaped head.
Very gay. It's gayism. Very gayistic. they approach their children's cartoons gayistically.
Yes.
Okay.
And then he said there was a picture of, I don't know if you saw this, but there was a picture of 2 male lions mounting that was circulated. And he commented on that picture and he said that the lions needed counseling. They needed to be separated.
Oh.
And I couldn't make this up. And then he said they must have seen a tourist couple in the national park and that's where they got that behavior from.
You know, the more you talk, the more it sounds like this man might be a gift to your cause, right?
No, but he's also, He's widely followed.
Oh, well, shit. I mean, we're always, of course, waiting for that moment where the ridiculousness, you know, of these dark forces will just sort of expose themselves and
But they have. They're exposed.
They are exposed.
They are exposed. They're not hiding.
That is incredible. I love this. I did not see that in all the, you know, sort of tourism videos they're playing on Kenya Airways. I'm like,
the homosexual lions.
To, you know, white gay men coming and
teaching the lions.
Teaching the lions
how not to procreate.
I know, and there's so much that can be explained, like sort of, you know, plummeting birth rates among endangered animals and God. Us tourists have brought a lot of
well maybe you can bring the counselors maybe you can bring the counselors as well the people because I'd like to see the people who go in and try and counsel the lions. Well,
that is true, yes, yeah. You could definitely if there were some choice sort of decision makers who you could volunteer for that job.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You know, you've been really good and strong on this anti-LGBT thing. Maybe you would like to go into
the Serengeti.
The Serengeti and counsel some lions for a little bit. I'm just thrilled. That is so it's so evocative of the absolute idiocracy that that does seem to just pop up every once in a while. And the fight does not end. I mean, this particular legal fight was 3 years even before the Supreme Court. Now you're saying there's appeal. And I mean, Rafiki was banned in what, 2010, 2000?
No, Rafiki was banned last year.
Last year, sorry. Mm.
But the Constitution was in 2010.
Okay. So, and how, I mean, like, how long will you fight this? Like, how?
Well, we'll fight it until we have an answer.
Okay. I wish I could show your face on the podcast, but you definitely made this fight is not going to end the way they think it is.
Well, it's just, it seems the Constitution is, I don't know. Maybe it's that absurd, naive optimist, but I'm just like, it's plain as day. Read the Constitution. It says freedom of expression. It doesn't say freedom of expression until two girls are kissing on screen. It doesn't say that.
Right.
In fact, it actually says what doesn't qualify under freedom of expression. And it's instigation of violence, instigation of terrorism.
Which, by the way, is what these rulings also do. Leave the door open for, I mean, even in Rafiki, there's violence. I mean, it's brutal.
It's not a walk in the park. Yeah. I'm not saying this is an easy love life. I'm saying, and the conversation that I was trying to have in Rafiki is sometimes, It's all based, there's this beautiful Lucille Clifton poem, and in it she says, "What have you ever traveled towards more than your own safety?" And it was just such a provocative thought, because people don't travel towards anything more than their own safety. And these girls were.
Right. That's the choice that you have to make.
Yeah.
Love or safety.
Love or safety.
What do you have? It's that toddy.
Yeah, it's getting, it's
it
good.
Does. Yeah. It's so good.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, that sort of demanding more of your drinks,
yeah,
is something that I feel like I get a lot of when I leave the States. They're just like, we need more flavor, you know, like we need more stuff happening in this, and I'm all for it. I think we should hold our drinks to a higher standard of like interest. So, what else are you doing? In the film world, I mean, you have, with all the success you've had here, you've also been able to reach back to Hollywood, to LA, because you had studied at USC, right?
UCLA.
Or UCLA.
Oh, dude.
Dude. I mean, I was. Roads and Kingdoms is a very Bruin-heavy organization, so
yeah,
I'm going to hear it for that. A million apologies. UCLA. But then you came back and really made your career here in Kenya. What's next for you, here or there, and how will you kind of balance those two?
It's super exciting. At the moment I am co-writing a series with, one of my favorite people in the world. Her name is Nnedi Okorafor. She's a novelist, and we're co-writing, a series that is an adaptation of our favorite author, Octavia Butler.
Wow.
and we're doing Wild Seed. And Wild Seed is our favorite book.
So it's just superlative all the way down.
Everything is just like great. And then the greatest piece of all of it, the cherry, not even the cherry, just like the whole top layer, is that we're working with Viola Davis's company, Juvie, to develop it, and we're developing it for Amazon.
That's the project. That's right, because you had mentioned that you were doing something with her production company. So that's it, and you're going to be doing it for Amazon.
Yeah.
And you talk about it with such joy, but writing is pain.
Is it, though?
How are you?
I feel like writing saves my life.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like writing saves my life.
You're one of those joyous writers.
It's just because the world doesn't make sense. And a long-lived person does. I'm just like, yes, they never die. That makes sense. But then Trump doesn't. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I think that writing saves my life. Writing is the place that I have. We create worlds. We create our ideas of what we can be and who we can be. We create how we want to vanquish our bad guys. You know what I mean? Like, we get to leave it there and then come back and try and make sense of this world again. But this world doesn't make sense. So, writing is truly life.
So that's it. Damn. Well, you make it sound very inviting.
People should write. Or find their joy. That's my joy.
Some way of understanding the world. All right. Well, and also writing collaboratively.
Oh, it's the best.
Based on all of these, it sounds like you have a lot of pillars of affection that are running through that project, which that can help you get through those those more difficult blank page moments.
Yeah.
So
I have no idea. We're still very much in the early stages and just super excited to be part of the project.
Yeah.
But I've also been attached to a Universal film called The Thing About Jellyfish. And it stars Millie Bobby Brown in it.
Okay.
And she's amazing.
Wow.
Hopefully that pans out as well. But, you know.
And when you're thinking about these projects, do you think about kind of, Hollywood and Nairobi?
The other East Coast.
The other East Coast, that's right. Do you think about them almost like they're opposed to each other, or that they work against each other? Do you have to choose one over the other?
No. I live in Kenya and I work where I work, but I live in Kenya. That's how I see it.
Is there a part of you that, you know, obviously the opportunities are immense and your mental life, it sounds like it's lived across all continents, right? I mean, you're talking about the collaborators you have, which who are not Kenyans, for sure. But how do you, is there some part of you that also wants to be able to build up the Kenyan film industry in a way? I mean, obviously by protecting it against the film classification board, that's a huge mitzvah.
Yeah.
But how does that, I mean, how's Kenyan film going, and you know, how possible is it for the next person who could step into a career like yours? How possible is that?
I think it's a lot more possible now than before. For the first time in a long time, in a large part due to a company called One Fine Day, there has been at least one feature film produced every year, almost for the last couple of years. And that's amazing for a country that never had any films coming out, you know? And that means that there've been filmmakers that have been made, there've been cinematographers that have been trained. It's so layered. It's so, so layered. And what I think is so great about having watched the films that have been coming out from Kenya over the last, even the last 5-6 years, is that we're properly indie. We're not like pop culture. We're like indie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We have really interesting thoughts and how we talk about them through either fantasy or through drama or through, I just think that we have, or even just through like an idea of a child's imagination and the supernatural has just been the most fascinating thing. So I think Kenya in itself has a really unique filmmaking voice.
So not to throw too much shade, but looking at Kenyan film versus some other places on the continent where it's like a lot of kung fu, you're feeling a depth of soul in the films that come out here.
Yeah, and character.
Yeah.
And like, and a really like auteur, like spirit and vision in the films, you know? It's just, it's something to be so proud of. It's just, I'm so excited. And the way that I want to help is by trying to create more content on this side and more TV, especially, because I think that's a really great way to learn on the job as well.
Mm, right, to kind of step up into feature films. Also probably to train and condition a viewing audience that they can get these kind of experiences out of pictures.
I think the audience is trained.
They're ready.
They have been.
Yeah.
I think we underestimate audiences because otherwise, I mean, even just very simply, Nollywood, the distribution of Nollywood films is far flung. It's just like, there's people watching Nollywood films everywhere.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Like there's people, like there's such, like the reach of different things is so far and wide that I think that it's not surprising anymore. The things that people have access to, even when they don't choose to, it's so varied and mostly because we're on the internet, so we'll see things that we wouldn't have seen necessarily. And we're no longer in like tiny villages, even though we want to try and keep our tweeps like super local. Things like you can't stop.
Yeah.
You can't stop what diversity looks like and what multicultural people and feelings and ideas are like. That I just, there's no space for that. And I mean, yeah, there's enough of an audience. I'm not worried about the audience. The audience is there.
Tell me to get to that hopeful ending. Tell me about, and I guess, you know, for the listeners too, what Afrofuturism means. I mean, it's been in some of your work, and I think you're a practitioner and supporter of the idea of it at a high level. What exactly is it, and what should people know about it?
Well, I think that there have been many different definitions of Afrofuturism. I think it was first coined by a man called Mark Derry, and it was more about speculative fiction, science fiction, mythical realism, anything that had to do with either black people or people from the diaspora. That was what was called Afrofuturism. And there's one of my co-writer, Nnedi Okorafor, coined the term African Futurism, which was a bit of a departure. And really that was stories and fantasy that stemmed from Africa first as well. And creating a new space for that and seeing that kind of work. Because a lot of it crystallized with Black Panther, and people are like, oh my gosh, there is Afrofuturism. So Afrofuturism and Black Panther become synonymous and as it should be.
Yeah. But what else? I mean,
but I think that there's other conversations, and I think that Nnedi Okorafor started pointing at the other conversations that we can have about African futurism, as well as Afrofuturism, and where the two meet, you know, because there is a complexity about just identity that I don't think that we completely unpack, and I think until we do, and have a firm understanding and embracing of all, then it will feel exclusive, and it's not that. You know,
exclusive in the sense that, you know, in the coming African century, there are gifts for the entire world.
Yeah.
Like there are ways of structuring our societies that that could be demonstrative to help us clear up some of our own bullshit.
Yeah. And also in a really super real way. And I know people keep saying it as Africa's the future, but Africa actually, with its population growth, just with really, really basic things, you know? I read like a really absurd statistic, like 1 in 5 people will be African by the year 2050. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like the number of Africans are coming.
It's happening.
It's happening. We're the youngest. We're the youngest continent, literally the youngest continent. Because with 77% of the population below the age of like 30.
Wow.
33, I think is the number.
My goodness.
It's just, it's a young, It's a young continent, and I think people need to start acknowledging that and thinking about Africa in a very clear, futuristic way. But apart from that, the space that I am growing into, that I am willingly growing into as well, and trying to define as this idea of Afro bubblegum.
Right. So you have a media company.
Well, it's not a media company. I think it's become more than a... I mean, yes, we do produce Afrobubblegum content.
That's good, because media is a rough business.
Yeah. But it's rather a description of fun, fierce, and frivolous African art. Because otherwise, we're only considered remorseful, right?
Not remorseful enough, mind you.
Exactly. But, and when we're not remorseful enough, maybe we're Afrobubblegum.
That's so fun, fierce, and frivolous.
Yes.
How does that? So, it sounds great. Sign me up.
Okay. So I am of the theory that there's always been Afro bubblegum art. There's always been fun, fierce, and frivolous expressions of joy through art and through tradition. And I have many. There's many traditions. There's many festivals that celebrate joy in really interesting ways. There's different types of art. There's magazines. There's photo comics that date back to the 50s that have like superheroes in spandex and taken pictures of, and they're like, you know, with karate chop motions. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's always been existed frivolous ways of Africans seeing themselves, but we don't see that anymore as much. So I wanted to create a space for us to see frivolous art and fun art and some things that are weird and obscure, and say this is what we've always been, because otherwise, and if we truly believe that seeing is believing and we don't see images of joy of ourselves,
right,
then how do we believe that we deserve joy? And how do we believe that we deserve more than what we're given? So I've been a firm advocate of joyful images of Black people, of people of color, of Africans, just so we can reclaim joy as an act of resistance and as a tool to see past all the fight and past all the struggle. What is our vision for ourselves? When we stop fighting, when the day comes, hallelujah, amen, when we stop fighting, what are we left with? What is the image? So we need to see joyful images of ourselves so that we can remember what we're doing.
That's fascinating. I mean, and especially, you know, not to call out some of my own bloodline, but you can look at, you know, the past few centuries of history and see that Northern Europe has had this incredibly outsized effect and dominion over so many parts of the world. And, you know, I've got a lot of that blood in me. It's a pretty fucking dour people, you know? I mean, I'll say it just so other people don't have to. There's a lot of like stone-faced, not like super exuberant. I mean, all of the structures, the religions, the Jantelagen in Denmark, all of these things are meant to drag you back to
suffer.
To this like stoicism of just, and that's the world that they've created essentially, like, you know, that in all of its different ways, that DNA, that dourness is kind of floating around the planet and getting people wrapped up in it, and they're hard to untangle from their own history and what they should do. So I love that idea of like, you know what, like, let's have another axis here.
Yeah.
Like joy could be an actual cultural absolute value that can be exported.
Yeah. And can be seen and can be experienced and has always been there. It's not new. We're not suddenly joyous. And also not in that super patronizing way that people go, Or visitors come and say, oh, they're poor, but they're so happy. Not in that kind of like substandard joy way. No, I reject that joy.
Just, I have a plastic bottle.
And look at how happy. No, no, that is condescending joy.
Right.
That is diminishing joy. That is not what we're talking about.
You're talking about joy that is a source of power.
As a source of power, but also as a source of culture, as a source of reference, as a source of historical context.
Afro bubblegum.
Afro bubblegum.
We're making that a thing. You are making that a thing.
And yes, I'm trying.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we'll be there with you.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for the dawah.
Anytime.
For bringing me to Leafy Karen.
Yes.
And for being on the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you.
And you. I'm really, really glad to be on it.
The Trip from Roads and Kingdoms is hosted by me, Nathan Thornburg. Emily Marinoff was our producer on this episode. Taffy Mukanyadze, our consulting producer. Alexa Van Sickle was our editor. Music by Dan the Automator. Episode illustration by Daisy D. Show artwork by Adele Rodriguez. Executive producers are me and Matt Goulding, also of Roads and Kingdoms. Update on the ever-shining career of Wanuri Kahiu, the guest of this episode. This autumn, it was announced that she would direct Paramount's film adaptation of The Hate U Give. The artist, still at it, making art, cannot wait to see what she comes up with. Next on this feed, we are back in Havana with Afro-Cuban artist, cook, and activist Nancy Cepero. All new episode coming Sunday. We will meet you there.